right. Hello, and welcome to a very nice episode of Shipping and Handling. I'm your host, Jennifer Edden.
And I'm your co-host, Bridget Smith.
You will hear some weirdness with the audio because, for two reasons. One, we are having internet problems, so we can't reach Ko-Fi to find our list of donors for this week. And also, we're recording in the front room of my apartment, which is on the street. And
there are outside noises.
There's a man who is very concerned about God walking by just now. So
yes.
It's going to be life's rich tapestry.
Oh, man, I haven't thought about the God yeller in my old neighborhood in a long time.
I know, right? There's always got to be at least one.
Right?
Right. We decided to make it extra nice for everybody. We would do an all questions episode of Shipping and Handling. So between our cobbled together cell phone service, we are going to just dive right in.
Yeah.
So first up, we have Megan, friend of the pod, Megan Eccles says, let's talk about sex in YA and crushes in middle grade. What's the line for you? Also, can you talk about the phenomenon of teen writers marrying and impregnating their 15-year-old characters, which I thought was just me, but apparently it's a thing. I have so many questions.
Yeah, same. I am not sure that I have enough experience with the latter experience there.
I did not know it was a thing.
I did not know that was a thing.
Not wild about it, to be honest.
But if that's what the teens themselves are writing.
I mean, whatever the youths...
Yeah.
The youths have been into weirder shit.
I suspect it's something having to do with wanting to feel grown up rather than actually wanting to have a baby.
Like, yeah, or get married.
That's what you do when you are an adult, is you get married and you have a baby. And that's what means that it's a lifelong love.
Or you're like me and you get a dog that you treat like your child.
But he's such a good dog.
Yeah, the studio audience, alas, is not here. Because he is at daycare, because now I'm one of those people who takes their dog to daycare. But in my defense, he loves it.
Oh,
he gets to play with other dogs.
Yeah,
he comes home and he's so sacked out.
Yeah.
It's not like his poor neglectful parents who just like won't
play
with him.
The only way you can get around not doing that is if you have either work from home or you have a job that brings you home a lot.
But even, you know, on the days that I work from home, I'm working. So it's not like I can just sort of be at his beck and call as much as he would like me. He's like, you're here.
Yeah.
Why are you not playing with me?
And he's also such a small puppy that, like, he needs a lot of stimulation.
He really does.
When I was a kid, our dogs, once they got to, like, 4 or 5, they sleep a lot of the time. And so when my mom was working from home, she could just, like, let them out into the yard. They would do their business and return home and then fall asleep on each other.
Yeah.
And like, that's easy enough to do.
The ideal model.
Yeah.
I don't have a yard. I have a parking pad that sort of doesn't have the same...
Not quite as fenced in and pleasant.
Well, let's go back to the first part of the question, which I think is maybe a little bit more manageable, which is about sex in YA and crushes in middle grade.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know where the line is for me. I mean...
Yeah. So I was at the World Fantasy Convention last weekend.
So was I.
And I was on a panel called What Makes It YA, which was a very difficult question to answer because there's like no real one defining factor. Mm-hmm. It's has to have teenagers, but not everything with teenagers is YA.
YA, yeah.
So whole thing. And so we talked a little bit about this, and there was one YA author who was sitting next to me, and we talked about this a little bit and kind of come down on the side of you can absolutely have sex in YA. You are not required to have sex in YA. I believe the current generation of teenagers is having the least sex of anyone from like the past 50 years when they were teenagers. So it's certainly not something that every teenager is doing, and you need to have it to be honest, but some certainly are.
Mm-hmm.
And so the line, I think, is making it more about the emotion rather than the physicality.
Yeah. I mean, I kind of like it when I encounter, sex scenes in YA, I kind of like it. It always weirds me out when someone's just like automatically really good at it. And I'm just like, oh, buddy. Like, I don't think that's how it would work. So when I encounter scenes where it's like really, you know, sort of like where people like where it's not always like super smooth. Especially if the characters are kind of able to like laugh about it, and then like, this is ludicrous. What are we trying to do with our bodies? Like, I kind of like that. And in terms of like crushes in middle grade, like, yeah, include them. I had so many weird crushes in middle grade.
Oh my god, so many
on people I knew and people I wanted to know and people I had never met before. Like, just It was like crush-a-thon. Like,
yes, and they were incredibly powerful crushes.
Oh my God, that feeling of just like, I would die if he looked at me. Just like, ugh, you know. Like, I was very Tina Belcher.
So yeah, I am all in favor of including crushes in middle grade. I don't think it's necessary. I think it's like, there's a much stronger push to have YA have romance, which I don't think it requires, but I know a lot of people really want to have romance in YA. And it's not the same kind of level of inclusion in middle grade. But it's absolutely a thing that kids are going through and will resonate with them.
Well, and they can be, like we were talking about, they can be so powerful and overwhelming that, you know, in terms of sort of like when you're thinking about the emotional drive of a plot, like that can be almost as powerful as sort of like the other things the characters want.
Stupid things you do.
I've done the stupidest things. And then, you know, the few relationships.
Like mild stalking.
Oh my God. It was totally normal when you're like, I'm just 12.
I'm just meeting my friend over here next to her locker that happens to be outside the classroom that you're leaving. That's no big deal.
No big deal. That happens all the time. Yeah, how dare you?
This is totally normal. I'm not here to say hi to you.
Exactly. All right, moving right along. I deeply appreciate everyone who has replied nice to my original tweet. It makes me feel real good.
Yep.
Michael Roth asks on Twitter, I have heard that it is best to query in rounds and refine the query and manuscript based on feedback each time. In theory, your submission should be better towards the end of the process. If you have dream editors, should you hold off and query them in one of the later rounds? I'm assuming you mean agents, because you can't really query editors.
Yeah. I absolutely see the reasoning behind this, but also what happens if someone in the first round wants it? Are you going to give that up in hopes of getting someone you had held off for a second round?
Yeah.
I think it's risky either way. And if you wind up having to do substantial revisions based on feedback, you can always go back to the people in the first round and say, I've revised. Would you be interested in taking another look?
Yeah. I mean, I think that the key thing is making sure that whatever you send out first is the best that you can make it at the moment.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you don't really get traction with that, you can absolutely revisit agencies with the new thing. But I would say that if there is someone that you really want to work with, like, why not query them first?
Yeah.
Or in the first round.
Yeah.
I definitely do agree that you should do it in rounds and not do, like, exclusivity.
Yes.
Because you want choices.
You also shouldn't do, like, 100 people at the same time.
Yeah, that's too many people.
It's too many people.
There's maybe, like, 100 good agents.
And that's also just, like, in case someone does come back with something where you're like, oh, my God, I can't believe I missed that. I need to change my entire manuscript. And, of course, now my query doesn't make any sense. That's why you also make sure that you have good options in later rounds as well. I wouldn't deliberately hold off on people you really want to work with.
This is not a question. Well, I guess it is a question. How is number 69 not sex themed or niceness themed, to be honest? From our friend Jamie Green. And then my client Kellen Sparrow says, why am I not guest appearing on the 69th episode, Jen? To which I can only answer, we didn't plan far enough in advance. So at 169, maybe. Yes.
Also, you know, we hoped that a question-themed episode would make our listeners say, oh, nice.
Exactly. So Melissa says, not a question, but I listened to Hello Lane Moore's entire audiobook yesterday, and her voice and intonation reminded me so much of yours. I don't know if she means me or you, but thank you.
I think it must be you because it was replying to your tweet, but maybe you have an alternate career as a
I slur my words too much. Like, I speak too quickly. Like, even when I'm not drinking, I'm just like, blah, blah. My mom's always like, can you say that again? I'm like, no.
It's gone now.
It's gone. My client Elise, Champs Elise, says, I guess for 69, tips on writing good sex scenes. When should you be explicit? When should you tastefully fade to black? Are there certain words you should avoid? I mean, I have things that I'm just like,
Yeah.
Like when I see it.
I'm just thinking of Allison Janney and 10 Things I Hate About You. None of the words that she used are words that you should use.
Quivering member. I like that. I mean, it's so, you know, it's so specific to the person reading. I mean, for me, there's things that, like, I mean, this, some of my clients listening will remember having this conversation with me. For me, I don't like the word cum being replaced with, like, C-U-M. Mm. It's just, like, a thing. I don't like it. I'm like, that's a noun. This is a verb. Like, we need, like, this, I don't like it. Yeah. But that's, again, a very specific thing. I don't know. For me, like, when I'm reading good sex, the thing that takes me out, I want to be sure that I'm not taken out of the moment.
Yeah.
So whatever keeps me in the moment, keeps me grounded with those characters, is what I kind of look for.
And yeah, to that I would go with like least obtrusive forms of writing.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, I think whether you choose to be explicit or to fade to black sort of depends on what else is going on in the book. If it's supposed to be a fairly minor emotional beat in a larger, in like a more, a sequence where the plot is really picking up, then I'd say maybe fade to black and don't derail the plot that way. But if that, if it's supposed to be actually a major plot point, then go for it.
Or if you can, I mean, I love sex with plot in it. Like, like, can you, I feel like all scenes should be doing double duty in some way, right?
Yeah.
And so if there's a way to make your sex scenes drive the plot,
related, yes,
forward, you know.
Yeah.
I love that. From friend of the pod, John Appel, he says, what are characteristics of a great ending for you, at least? And for writers penning the standalone series potential, any thoughts about how to leave some breadcrumbs or dangling threads for future books? That's a good question.
It is. Yeah, for a good ending, the most important thing to me is the feeling of satisfaction at the end of it. I don't need to have every thread neatly wrapped up. In fact, sometimes making sure that you get all of the threads, I'm just like, oh God, we're just tying knots now. This is,
and if you recall, in chapter three, yes, when I was speaking to this person.
But yeah, having the major things that you've set up come back together in a satisfying way, in a way that resolves a major arc for the character, that is part of what makes a really good ending for me.
Yeah. Yeah, and in terms of seeding the future in your book, I think, you know, the more expansive your world is, that kind of leads to its own possibilities. Like,
absolutely.
Especially if you're writing in genre, if you have sort of an idea of how the world works, the more fleshed out that is in your mind and on the page, the more the reader's like, oh, but what about this?
Yeah.
And kind of following those threads down whatever path they lead to.
And it's also, you know, you're stopping, basically you're stopping at a point in this character's life, and there's going to be more life afterwards. And so we've all had those times when we feel like everything has come to a satisfying conclusion, something we've been really building towards has paid off, and it's so exciting and wonderful and satisfying. And then, you know, you wake up the next morning and your life continues.
Yeah.
So
what comes next?
Yes. So, and there's all these other things that have been going on in the background while you focused on this one major thing.
Mm-hmm.
As a former teen athlete, I am thinking of a lot of championship tournaments. And so that's also just a way to think about it, is what else is going on in this character's life that we might want to follow into the next stage,
or even in the world that could sort of insert itself into the character's life. Like, in what ways does the world touch their life in ways that maybe push them off the path that they've kind of found for themselves?
Yeah.
I'm thinking about, I mean, just because it's kind of on my mind, because I read recently Ninth House. The sort of main thread of Ninth House is wrapped up pretty satisfactorily. But one of the subplots, they get an answer at the end, but it's not, but like the answer, like the sort of solution to that answer isn't going to come until the next book.
Okay.
So there's stuff happening, but it doesn't necessarily all sort of like tie up very neatly.
And if it's, especially if the solution to the question that has been driving so much of the book is just opens questions of its own. It, it like doesn't actually resolve anything. It's like, oh, okay. So we got to the end of the thing, but it's not done yet.
Yeah.
We've got more steps to go.
Yeah. There's more stuff.
Yeah.
All right. So we're running out on Twitter, but I think we have some on Tumblr, which I have on my phone because my internet sucks. All right. Cool Shades Anon asks, say, although weirdly the, oh no, never mind. I was looking at the wrong logo. I was like, where'd the shades go? I'm just looking in the wrong place. Cool Shades Anon asks, say you're having a serious but likely not life-threatening, could be life-threatening, but probably won't be surgery. Do you tell your agent? And if so, when? And what do you want to have in place before the slicing commences? I'd like to know.
Yeah. I mean, partly because I'd like to send you a nice card or like a fruit basket or something.
Or a message saying like, I hope your recovery is good.
Yes. And especially if you're, if something's going on, like if you're book is on submission or something, like I want to know. One of my clients told me she's expecting a baby in December and her book's on submission. So I'm like, hopefully we can, I'll have news for you before the baby comes because you're going to be very occupied for a while.
Yeah.
And yeah, I think that's something that's just like nice to say, by the way, I'm having this surgery.
Well, I think it sort of goes back to what we were kind of talking about last week in the sort of self-care episode, which when I listened to it, I was like, wow, we were really loopy. you know, we, if it's going to affect, you know, first of all, we're concerned about your, you know, our clients and, you know, for their well-being, but also if it's going to affect any of your quote unquote deliverables, you know, deadlines, you know, publicity and stuff, you know, we need to know about it so that we can make sure that the publisher is kind of proceeding accordingly, you know, so that everyone's expectations are kind of like set.
Yeah. Make sure everyone is asking reasonable things from you while you're in recovery.
Exactly. Because it's like, oh, so I know that you just had like major abdominal surgery, but like also can you like go to Toronto? And it's like, no.
Yeah.
You can't go to Toronto.
And yeah, if you're, I mean, if you are worried about it turning out to be life-threatening, it's always good, as soon as you start your writing career, to have a plan in place for who handles the rights after your death and who gets the money.
Regardless if you're planning on having...
Yes.
Just have an executor.
It could happen. You never know.
You could get hit by a bus.
Yep.
You could, I don't know, all kinds of weird shit can happen to you. And don't be Prince.
Yes.
Don't...
Oh, my God.
Don't die intestate. Maybe don't shove your will under a couch like Aretha Franklin.
Yeah, and if you're fairly early, you can sort of, in your career, you can put together something straightforward. But yeah, make sure you know who's going to be handling all of that. Make sure the person who's going to be handling that knows it and it's like written down.
Yeah, and they know a little bit of what they're doing.
Yeah.
Which is always helpful. Another Cool Shades Anon asks, thoughts on MFAs and if they are worth the time and money?
I think it varies widely.
Yeah.
I think you absolutely do not need an MFA to be a professional writer. Some people find them very helpful and find that they really improve their writing. Depends on the program. Some of them are really like incredibly expensive and not going to improve your career prospects enough to make up for it. Some give you a lot of flexibility and that might and like are cheaper, and so that might be more worthwhile. Yeah, there's no easy yes or no answer here.
Well, I think you got to think about what you know, what kind of things you want to be doing, like what kind of, you know, what space do you want to be writing in? Because I think that the only arena in which having an MFA might be super helpful is sort of really literary fiction.
Mm-hmm.
Not even necessarily for the craft part of it, but for the networking part of it. Because, you know, it's sort of a cheap, not cheap, but, you know, a quick and dirty way of getting a built-in cohort where you have a network of people that whose work you've read and whose work you've workshopped and they've workshopped
who
yours.
Hopefully are rooting for you.
Who hopefully are rooting for you the way that you're rooting for them. Yeah. You know, it can...
Don't go to an MFA program and make enemies.
Maybe not a great idea. But yeah, I mean, I think that that's the only situation in which I think, like, you know, maybe. But also, there's no guarantee that having that network in place would actually get you where you want to go.
Yeah.
And especially this is a very tough question when it comes to like genre work, because there's only a couple of places in the country that have MFAs that specialize in commercial or genre fiction.
And a lot of them are still very, although some of them are like, oh, we'll be, we're okay with magical realism, but no like straight fantasy.
Yeah.
And so it's, you got to make sure it's the right one for you. And just really it's whether it's worthwhile to you is the most important thing.
Like, what do you want to learn? Like, because there's a lot of, I mean, you know, colleges have classes, like, you know, continuing education stuff. There's also things like, you know, sort of like retreats, like Highlights runs a million retreats that like, the more I learn about them, I'm like, those sound amazing, where they're sort of similar, you know, environments where you're sort of workshopping stuff with people. But you don't have to necessarily shell out for, you know, 200 and however many thousands of dollars.
Yeah, I like the idea of doing sort of a class just as a test run, like at a local college or online or something. And so you just see, like, is this actually, how is this making me feel? Do I feel it was worth the money? Yeah. Do I feel that it's improved my writing?
Yeah. I feel like the single biggest thing anyone can do for their writing in general is just read a lot.
Yes.
And read widely, because I think you'll learn, because a lot of what you'll be doing in MFA classes is like dissecting published works anyway.
Yeah.
So the more you do that kind of on your own.
Actually, Sarah LaPola, who is also an agent and does some writing as well. She wanted to do an MFA, but like couldn't justify the cost to herself. So she just basically spent a year and created just a list of works that she was going to read and dissect herself.
Interesting.
And so it was like a self-directed MFA thing. And so, of course, you don't come out of it with the degree, but you also don't come out of it with the debt.
Yeah. Yeah.
So she had something on that on her website about that. And that might be worth looking into. We can find a link and put it in the notes.
I was like, I want to read that. All right. Another Cool Shades Anon asks, I submitted my first query and I see so they submitted their first query and one of us rejected them. Sorry. But it was very exciting because you said that the premise was good, but the first pages did not draw you in. Do you recommend any webinars to teach me more about how to prep my first 10 pages for query? I learned so much from you guys every time I listen. Thank you. There's actually a book called The First 5 Pages, I think.
Oh, okay.
That I actually have not read, so this is not a wholehearted recommendation, but I was at a conference recently and it was recommended a lot by people as a way of kind of like looking at specifically the opening of a story and how you make that compelling. So that might be a resource.
Yeah. I think this is often a focus of the MSWL, what is it, Manuscript Academy?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Webinars, as they do a lot of stuff on how to grab an agent's attention. And so a lot of that is focused on the query in the first 5 or 10 pages.
Yeah. All right.
Also, if you do children's books, SCBWI does a fair amount of those as well.
Yeah. Check out all of, I think all, you know, RWA as well has some of those. All right. Well, I don't have a ton of questions. Let me see if I can just call up my email. I did tweet it kind of late. No, the other ones we have are kind of old.
Okay. From another Cool Shades Anon. If I call out a book on Twitter, am I burning bridges with people connected to that book? For example, author, editor, agent. There's this great book that I love, but part of it plays into harmful ableist stereotypes about chronically ill people. I am chronically ill and I want to say something, but the book is published by Dream Publisher and edited by Dream Editor, and I don't want to kiss those dreams goodbye just yet. Is it critical commentary acceptable from someone trying to break into publishing?
That is a good question, and I think that it's one that people have been kind of, you know, struggling with. I think that there's ways to do it that burn bridges and there's ways to do it that don't.
Yeah,
this might be an opportunity for like a blog post or something a little bit more nuanced.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm sort of hesitant to be like, yeah, burn it down, because that would actually,
yeah,
because they're going to remember.
Yeah.
But nor should you feel that thoughtful critique
will ruin your career.
Because it won't.
No.
I mean, really, the only, I really don't think that thoughtful critique would be that big of a problem.
Yeah, I think especially if you start it with, look, I really love this book and there's so much about it that I think it's wonderful, but I'm wanted to mention this aspect. Yeah. And like, don't, you know, tag everyone into it.
That's the other thing. A lot of the times it's sort of like, the things that kind of escalate is like sort of personal attacks on the editor or like the publisher.
How dare you? And
you know, you idiots, you don't know what you're doing. Like they probably didn't know what they're doing.
Yeah.
Because it's a problem in the industry where no one, you know, there's a very small slice of experience that is sort of sitting in these seats. So, you know, keeping that in mind, I think absolutely, like, you know, bring your experience to the fore and
yeah, I think if it's also, if you handle it in sort of a nuanced and careful way, that sometimes people are actually even impressed with that.
Yeah, they're like, oh, I hadn't thought about that.
Yeah.
I mean, oftentimes, you know, when people get that kind of feedback, it's like, oh, I hadn't thought about that.
Like, yeah, it's like, I can't believe I missed that. Like, that's,
and as long as you don't follow that up with like, yeah, you dummy, you know, the ad hominem kind of thing. So sort of like, ugh.
All right. I do definitely sympathize with that, though, because I also feel like it's hard to say on Twitter, like, oh, I didn't even like this book. And so it's so much harder when it's something fraught like that.
Yeah. Especially when, did we get a tweet?
No. Oh, no, it's my reminder about the podcast. Too late, phone.
So hello, and we're kind of going back in our archives of messages, because why not? So if we've answered this twice, our apologies. Hello, lovely ladies. If I want to write under a pen name, should I use my real name or pen name when querying? Or should pen names be a discussion I have with my agent once I land one? It doesn't really matter.
Yeah, I think you should. I would honestly suggest putting both names in the email. Just say, like, this is my real name. This is the name I'm writing under.
Real name writing as pen name.
Because what gets really weird is when you're corresponding with someone under their pen name and then they forget that they were writing to you under their pen name and sign it with their real name. And you're like, who am I talking to?
Yeah.
What is happening?
Whomst?
That's always very unnerving. So I think being very upfront about, like, this is my name and this is the name I'd like to write under is just...
I mean, yeah. one of my clients, the email that they use to correspond is their pen name. Mm. And, you know, she's like, yeah, I've got a legal name, but like, this is what I use.
Yeah.
And so like,
I think that's very reasonable.
Yeah. Ooh, here's an interesting one. Is it worth mentioning to my agent that I wish they would read my manuscripts faster? I feel extremely... I understand that people... Oh no, did you spit tea out?
Nope.
I understand that people are supposed to tell their agents if there's something they'd like them to change, but with manuscript reading time, it doesn't seem like they could magically speed it up, because if they could, I'm sure they would. Is there a more productive way to phrase the question / broach the topic of, hey, I think this rate could slow down my career, or is it set in stone pretty much? Well, I feel extremely attacked, but yeah. Also, this is a good question, you were right to ask it.
Yes.
I think it's absolutely worth bringing up
yeah.
to your agent that... You know, it's been, especially if they gave you a timeline of when they thought they'd get it to you and they didn't.
Yeah.
Which is something that's never happened to me. You know, it's always worth bringing up concerns.
Yeah. Yeah. And the answer to that might be like, we're still going to be doing a book a year and more than that is not totally recommended anyway, or something similar. But it's worth raising.
Well, I think it's worth raising sort of, especially if you're sort of at the beginning part of your career and you haven't had anything on sub yet and you want to make sure you don't miss your window.
Yeah.
I think that that's fair. I think that regardless, it's a fair...
And if it's been like 9 months since you signed with them and they haven't gotten you edits yet, like at that point.
Yeah. I mean, and you know, as much as we always say like, we're busy, like it's our job.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, it's our job to...
Yeah.
You know, be communicative and to give you this information. So
I currently feeling I haven't been able to actually read a manuscript thoughtfully in months, and as a result I'm like, that was also the month when all of my clients sent me manuscripts, and I'm like, I very much want to be reading these. I hate the list that's waiting for me. I hate that I'm like bored of not being able to read them. I want to read them all, and yet here I am, unable to provide thoughtful feedback on anything and quitting very charming books after about 15 pages because they're irritating me.
Yeah.
So
it's legit. And you know, I think too that one of the frustrating things from author's side is that, you know, sort of they don't necessarily know that we're agonizing about how behind we are.
Yeah.
And there's no way to sort of communicate that without making us sound like jerks.
Yeah.
I think like, oh my God, I'm so busy. I'm so sorry. Like,
yeah.
That just sounds like I'm too busy for you, you know, like, and I'm totally guilty of it. So yeah, real, real dark nighttime of the soul over here. I don't think, did we answer this one? Oh, great. You want to read that one?
Sure. Hello, Jen Bridget from Cool Shades Not. I've got a question from my writer group chat. A YA writer I follow recently got featured in Tor for one of her short stories, and we noticed a lot of industry peeps commenting that they'd read it / sharing it. Most of us are querying or agented but pre-sub, and we're wondering from an agent's POV, can short fic help strategically to get your name out there? Do agents like when their clients do this, or are we better off focusing on our books instead of learning a new form? Yeah, it absolutely can help. But also if it's not something that you enjoy doing, I wouldn't recommend it.
It really only moves the needle if it's in a genre that you want to move into.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, the thing about YA writers writing short fiction in the adult space is that usually it's sort of a prelude to a crossover.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. So if you're a YA writer who wants to be published as a YA writer, having an adult short fiction piece isn't necessarily going to, right?
Unless it winds up being like award winning, in which case you can say like,
but does the YA space really care about like the sort of like genre awards? Like, I don't know if Nebula has ever.
I think it is helpful if you can say like, this is a Hugo winning author who is now writing their like YA fantasy novel.
Yeah, I guess that's true.
If you're writing like YA contemporary, then no. But
I think it's useful in the sense of, you know, when you mentioned that people were sharing it, and that it was being kind of shared around, like that's also useful that, you know, there were people who were interested in it and were reading it. So it sort of adds to like your readership and sort of that network, especially if there were like industry professionals reading it. But you don't really want to write short fiction if you're just doing it for like career reasons. It's like,
yeah, if you enjoy writing it, then absolutely it can be helpful. But I wouldn't force yourself to write it.
Cool Shades Anon asks, do you get royalty statements no matter what, or only if you are earning royalties?
You should get them no matter what. Some contracts will try to say that you only get them if you're earning money, but pretty much any agent should say, no, you're going to send them regardless.
Yes. Sometimes they'll hold payment if it's under a certain amount.
Yeah.
But yes, you should be getting a statement of sales regardless. So, hello, queens of the podcast universe. I wanted to get your opinions on Pitch Wars since it is coming up. It came up in the past. This is many months later. Does knowing that a book has been through that process add any value to you? Do you think it's helpful or gimmicky? Do you pay more attention to those books than the ones that are in your slush?
Sometimes the you have to pay faster attention to the ones that are in Pitch Wars, because often if they're going to get an offer, they do so very right quickly. Away, yeah. I remember doing Pitch Wars one year and having 3 or 4 manuscripts that had offers over Thanksgiving weekend. And so I like had to spend the entire weekend just reading things.
Yeah.
Well, that was no fun.
I mean, I honestly haven't participated in a pitch contest in a while, just because, and I know that this is like a different, Pitch Wars is a different animal, but I feel like I get so many queries that I also am not like timely in responding to that I don't want to necessarily add to that workload.
Yeah.
Maybe someday I'll be at a different place. Yeah. I'm now at a no response means no agency, which is also like a weird adjustment to make, because I've always been like, it's a bad idea. Now I'm like, no, it seems like a great idea now, because it's so much less work. I still try to respond to everything, but yeah.
It doesn't necessarily add any value for me. It's kind of a neutral fact.
Yeah.
If I get a query like afterwards, that's like, this
is certainly not a negative.
Yeah.
You know, it's not, I wouldn't say that it's gimmicky.
Yeah.
I would just say that it sort of changes the timeline on how I respond to things.
Yeah. I wouldn't, as long as you're not like making a whole big deal about like, I was featured in Pitch Wars, I'm like, you can just include that line at the end of it, and yeah, it can be helpful or not. So we have a lengthy question from A Cool Shades Anon. Do we want to answer these questions as they come up, or do we want me to read the whole thing and discuss?
Maybe read the whole thing and discuss.
Okay.
I feel like there's a lot going on there.
Yeah. Okay. In my day job, I am a strong proponent of salary transparency. I think that hiding that information only helps the company, not the workers. Marginalized folks need to be able to tell if they are being paid fairly for their work. People new to the workforce deserve to have an idea of the market rate, etc. That being said, I feel like sharing advance information, even privately among writing friends, seems like it's frowned upon. I guess between 10,000 and 50,000 are both normal, and I get that it might be bragging to tell people what you make for art, but like, I know that my agent and I didn't talk about what was considered normal until I got an offer. Should authors talk about this sort of stuff amongst each other? If not, how is this different than with salary transparency in the workplace? If so, how should we be having these conversations? What is productive? Sorry, this might be a whole podcast topic on its own. Lol. Last thing, it is thanks to a podcast y'all did that I knew that $49,000 was considered a big advance for a standalone, even though it's on the lowest bracket of that nice deal thing. Your one quote was my frame of reference going into this, so thank you. Don't worry, I have a good agent, but the explaining all happened after the offers. I love that y'all gave me specific numbers and reference points before. I should buy y'all wine.
Well, thank you. I don't think that it's an exact one-to-one correlation with salary and advances.
Yeah.
Because as we said in our episode about that one article that drove us all nuts, you are not an employee of the publishing company. They are purchasing something from, they're licensing something from you.
Yeah.
And the value of the thing that they are licensing from you in their eyes might be different from the value that they are licensing from someone else. That being said, I think that it's perfectly acceptable to share advanced information among your friends.
I think that the other part of this is that it really is something so personal for a lot of people. And so it can be hard to like talk about how much this thing that you've created and that means so much to you, how much it's valued by the marketplace.
Yeah. Because that value is different for everybody, it's hard to give people context about.
And
it was like, quote unquote, only $10,000. But $10,000 in this scenario is actually quite good, you know? Yeah. Like,
or like, and it varies so much by publisher as well.
Yeah.
Where like an advance, the same exact advance can be a nothing offer from one publisher and a huge statement of belief in the book
from
a
another.
Different publisher.
And I think, you know, the tough thing, too, is, you know, I've had clients ask me, you know, what's a normal advance range for something? And I always have to say, like, there is no normal because it could be different from publisher to publisher, from editor to editor, you know, because an editor at one house might be at a level where they can ask for such and such amount of money.
Yeah.
But an editor at a different house might be in a position where they can ask for more.
Mm-hmm.
And so even though it's theoretically the same product, depending on where it is.
Yeah. But depending on which editor falls in love with it and wants to buy it,
yeah,
can change so much.
I mean, I don't necessarily think that, like, advanced disclosure is sort of on the same level of, like, you know, of the necessity of transparency as salary. But I do think that there are situations in which it's useful to compare two similar books with two different kinds of authors and mm-hmm. say, like, okay, well, this is, like, the same publisher, a similar kind of book.
Yeah.
Who's getting... I think that that is sometimes a very useful question to ask because, yeah, like we were saying earlier, like, there is real disparities in this.
But the thing you have to look for there is big picture trends.
Mm-hmm.
It's not helpful to compare two specific individual advances because there are so many factors that go into it.
Yeah.
It's not like you're working the same job at the same company. And you can say, like, there is absolutely no reason you should value this person's work over mine. But so you have to look at the big picture trends of who is getting the huge advances, who's getting the second chances after those huge advances don't earn out.
Yeah, I think that the sort of, you're right, it's the later, it's the larger information that I think is more,
yeah,
useful. That's why the like the Lee and Lowe survey is so useful.
Mm-hmm.
Although I don't think that that looks into advance size, does it?
No, I don't think so.
The Vita, I guess Vita doesn't either.
I mean, it's that information isn't anywhere.
Yeah.
Even Publishers Marketplace, where the 90% of the advances per book will fall into the nice category. So.
And now we've come around to the true meaning of this episode, a nice. I would say most of the deals I've ever done are in the nice category. You know,
yeah, like if they wind up in the very nice category, it's because there were two books involved.
Exactly, yeah. It's like nice per book, but very nice, taken as a...
Yes.
Yeah, the title of this episode is going to be Nice Smiley Face. Let's see if there's anything else interesting in this range. Someone asked, Dear Bridget and Jen, first of all, I love the podcast and I've started my own Vorkosigan reread because of you. Not a question, but I just listened to your Jurassic World and Mad Max podcast and my thought was, sweet summer children, just wait until Fallen Kingdom. I'd love it if you ever find 10 minutes to rant about that awfulness. It was truly awful.
I have not seen it.
Don't. It's bunkers in the least satisfying way.
Ugh.
Hate that. Yeah, pretty much. All right, so we're at about the 45-minute mark. We are out of questions that are easily accessible, so sorry about that. So, Bridget, what are you reading these days?
So I recently read Silver in the Wood by Emily Tesh, which is a Tor.com novella.
It's got a great cover.
Yeah, it does. I picked it up at World Fantasy. It was not in my free books bag, but when I went down to drop off the enormous hardcovers that I didn't intend to read and also did not want to trek home on my plane, I found it just sitting there in the free books pile. I was like, ooh, I want this one. And also, it's very small and I can easily take it home. And I wound up reading it in the airport while I was waiting for my flight, and it was very lovely and charming. It's very much this sort of, like, hardcore local English folklore thing where you have different legends about the same patch of woods based on, like, which side of the woods you live on. And I really loved that angle of it, and it's just, it was very lovely. Recommend it. Also, it's a novella. It's like 100 pages long.
Love
it's
that.
A very quick read. Also, it was very funny. I went on to Goodreads to like write my little review of it and happened to glance at the questions, and there was one person who had asked, is this book YA or adult? And two people were like, it's not YA, there are no teenagers. And it's like, yes, you know what this question is about. And the other two were like, I don't know what would make it adult, there's no sex in it. And I was like, oh god. One even, like, stretched and found homophobia in this question to be mad at, which was like, I don't know why you would consider it adult because two men kiss. But that's happening a lot in YA now these days.
Lord.
It's like, you are so close to figuring out that the question was not about sex. So close, and yet so far.
Yeah. Oh my god, story of our lives, really. Like, oh, you're almost there.
You're almost there. I also recently started reading Red, White, and Royal Blue by Casey McQuiston, which is very charming and also is running up into my thing where I'm like, I read about 30 pages of it and I'm like, oh, this is so fun and charming and adorable. And then I start to get annoyed and I'm like, ah, yes, this is a me problem, not a book problem. Time to put it down and go do dumb crossword puzzles until I fall asleep.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. I will be curious to hear what you think when you finish it.
Have you read it?
I have. Okay. I read it on vacation this year.
Okay.
Are you done with?
Yes, I am done. What are you reading, Jen?
I am reading, I'm midway through two books. Well, I'm sort of more of the way through one. One of them is, it's called I Used to Be Charming, The Rest of Eve Babbitts. She, is this author who, or this writer who wrote a lot for a bunch of different kinds of magazines and stuff. And she grew up in LA, sort of 50s, 60s, and sort of all through the hippie years and up in, you know. Mm-hmm. And she just has this really, I haven't highlighted in a book in ages, and I keep underlining things. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is so good. Just really, really good. I bought that one at a bookstore in Tulsa when I was there. And then I just got, over the weekend, the new Erin Morgenstern, The Starless Sea. And I'm only about 100 pages into that. And so far, I like it.
Okay.
But it's fun. It's very different from The Night Circus in that there's a lot of sort of like very specific pop culture references. And I haven't yet decided how I feel about that, because I often find that pop culture references kind of take me out of the story. Yeah. But so we'll see. I don't know. But so far, I like it. So it's a very sort of page-turny read, which I enjoy, because I'm like, I don't want to think about it. I want to watch more Midsummer Murders, except I can't because my fucking internet's not working. So that's fun for me. But well, thank you to everyone who sent in your very nice questions for our 69th episode.
Nice.
And thank you to our donors for this week. And until next time, happy reading. Bye.